In addition to these components, the role of Spain in importing and diffusing New World gold and silver was a powerful global force during the 16th and early 17th centuries. Between 1540 and 1660, a total of 16,900 tons of silver and 181 tons of gold came to Europe, the largest proportional increase in bullion ever, and enough to expand the money stock of Europe by about 50% by 1660. This was the all-important influx by which European wealth and power vaulted ahead of the hitherto larger treasuries of Mughal India, Ottoman Turkey, and Ming China. Spanish bullion spread across Europe and around the globe. By one French analysis, it was not just the King of Spain who was interested in the precious metals, but all the merchants of Sevilla and all the merchants of Antwerp, Augsburg, Genoa, and Rouen, who hastened to garner the profits on what they had exported. Once the returning flota hove into view, couriers carried the good or bad news to the four corners of the world. War also sped the circulation of silver, as Spain used it to fund military campaigns in Morocco, Italy, and Holland. Nor was the effect limited to Europe. The Manila galleons, based in the Spanish Philippines, carried so much commerce and coin, each year half the sum of the Atlantic traffic, that Spanish silver became the principal currency of Southeast Asia. Spain thus became the figurative lode mined by the embryonic Western European financial services industry. The real figures for the trade, if we take into account all its sectors, are impossible to quantify, said historian Henry Kamen. This vast commercial enterprise had the outward form of an empire dominated by Spain. Viewed from the inside, however, it was a structure in which all the essential arteries were controlled by non-Spaniards. Like the Castilian Parliament nearly 80 years earlier, the native merchants of Seville protested in 1627, "Our people are without sustenance and income, the foreigners are rich, and Spain, instead of being a mother to her sons, has ended up as a foster mother, enriching outsiders and neglecting her own." Manifestly, this draining, superimposed financial services economy was not a framework for long-term Spanish economic success. González de Sayorigo, the economist cum reformer, was prescient in identifying the underlying problem. Money, he wrote, was not necessarily wealth unless it was expended on things that yield profits and attract riches from outside to augment the riches from within. Instead of productive investment, the flow of bullion had created a false sense of wealth and diverted Spaniards from work to dreams. At the same time, he erred in labeling the foreign money men as mere parasites. In fact, they were uniquely able to do what the Castilian ruling class wanted: employ European networks to finance Castile's non-economic priorities of crossbow and crucifix. For 17th century Dutch and 18th and 19th century Britons, by contrast, the late stage influence of finance evolved from earlier commercial and industrial strength. As we have seen, activities solidly rooted in the real economy. For the Dutch, fisheries, whaling, shipbuilding, and textile production. For the British, coal, maritime success, textiles, railroads, and iron and steel prospered amid business climates of technological innovation, capital formation, and a timely energy source. Production of goods for export thrived. After two or three generations, the innovation weakened and the industries lost some competitiveness. Each nation's worldwide connections and buildup of capital and financial services encouraged a rising emphasis on stock and bond markets, insurance, brokerage, globe-girdling finance, and the emergence of large rentier communities. As the imperial apogees approached, the potential return from investing money domestically came to seem inadequate, and both nations' creditor and financial classes began to move more and more funds into overseas investments. For the 18th century Dutch, these were principally British stocks and government debt, and for the British of 1900 to 1914, one could mention Indian tea plantations, American railroads, and Argentine ranches and banks. As industry lost its edge, foreign scientists and students often left for home. Some native-born scientists, engineers, and skilled craftsmen decided to emigrate, from Holland to England, Germany, and Sweden, from Britain to the United States. Wars became ever more of a budgetary and economic strain. Debt and currency crises grew increasingly frequent. However, if the United States seems to be wandering down an altogether familiar pathway, that is not strictly the case. In the quarter century since 1980, manufacturing in the United States has diminished and been displaced by finance far beyond what happened in early 20th century Britain. We will return to the comparative statistics, but Alan Greenspan's own comments have relevance. In the early 80s, as a private economist, he talked about reducing the federal budget deficit to help make U.S. manufacturing competitive again. By July 2003, as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, he voiced a different analysis. Is it important for an economy to have manufacturing? There is a big dispute on this issue. What is important is that economies create value, and whether value is created by taking raw materials and fabricating them into something consumers want, or value is created by various services which consumers want, presumably should not make any difference so far as standards of living are concerned. This, indeed, is the dispute. Part is theoretical. The so-called post-industrial scenario versus the argument that hard industries still remain imperative. But another significant element, to which we now turn, is the influence that can entrench around a large rentier class, or, as in America now, around a debt and creditor complex.